Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yes, this week's show is a day early. I'm hopping on a plane tomorrow to fly to Brazil with Mrs. Business and Baby Business, and Brazil is far, and the routing wasn't as flexible as I would have liked, so yeah, it couldn't be helped, I'm afraid. I was a bit worried that there wouldn't be enough to talk about if we ran a day early, but a fair bit has happened over the last 6 days, and we'll be covering that off in this week's news segment with Adam Boileau in just a moment. This week's show is brought to you by Trail of Bits. Trail of Bits is a security engineering firm and consultancy based in New York. They aren't really like a pen testing firm. They build as well as break, and you can find them at trailofbits.com. In this week's sponsor interview, JP Smith from Trail of Bits will be joining us to talk about the work he put into Seesaw, not the Center for Sustainable Architecture with Wood, which is a thing, but the Cybersecurity Awareness Worldwide, CTF. Now, JP is a sick man. He's sick. In a little while, you'll hear about the mind-bending CTF challenges he put together for Seesaw. But you know what? Remarkably, some teams were actually able to solve his problems, some of which featured complex numbers mapped to a four-dimensional unit sphere being used to drive the rotation of a virtual IBM Selectric typewriter golf ball in Second Life. As I say, he is a sick man. That one is coming up later, but first off, we're going to check out some recent security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, we've seen another Huawei staffer arrested, this time in Poland. He was taken into custody along with another gentleman who used to work for a Polish intelligence service. It's interesting too, because although he is a sales manager, or was a sales manager with Huawei, he's been fired since. Apparently he was for a time posted at the Chinese embassy in Poland.
Yes, according to his LinkedIn, he used to be an attaché at the embassy, and we all know what that means. But yeah, this story's been a little murky. I mean, Huawei firing him pretty much straight after this came to light was an interesting twist to it. But of course, it's been, you know, kind of tied together with the general concerns about Huawei, although we don't necessarily know that all of the things are you know, related in this particular case. But yeah, it's not a good look. And yes, this Mr. Wang Weijing, we'll see what happens to him, I guess.
Yeah, but it's pretty funny. Huawei are like, he's fired. Who is this guy anyway? It had nothing to do with us. go away. Now, look, our next story, this one's really interesting in that I haven't seen it pop up anywhere else. Like, I fired off a tweet and, you know, it just did not resonate. And I was kind of surprised by that because, to me, this is pretty big news. A bank manager in the Philippines has been found guilty of money laundering offenses relating to the, you know, the SWIFT hack against the Bangladesh Central Bank. I would have thought this would be bigger news in InfoSec.
Yeah, I mean, this investigation has been grinding on for a while as people followed the money around. And this particular case is against Maya de Guito, who's a Philippine bank manager. She apparently opened several of the bank accounts that were used to, you know, move the money from Bank of Bangladesh through and onwards to China. She says that she opened them at the behest of a, you know, casino operator who has then, you know, not apparently been, you know, found to be involved in this process. And then, yeah, she's been found guilty of money laundering, even though, I mean, she kind of didn't directly handle the money herself. She created the accounts moved through the bank from those accounts, and that was, you know, kind of the end of her involvement as far as we know.
It totally looks like they've just set her up as a patsy, hey?
It does kind of a bit. The guy that runs apparently a casino out of the Midas Hotel in the Philippines ordered her to set up the accounts, and then the money went through those accounts to some other guy, and then from there to some other company. And yeah, none of those people are apparently guilty of anything, and apparently she is for opening bank accounts in what turned out to be false names. So yeah, probably not a great job.
No sentencing yet on that one, but you know, we'll pay attention. I actually heard that one on ABC Radio and then went and looked it up. And yeah, as I say, just surprised that it hasn't received much coverage. Now, the El Chapo trial just keeps on delivering.
Yes, apparently one of the revelations that's come out this week is that El Chapo was having his IT people backdoor the phones and laptops of various people so that El Chapo could listen to the microphones after he'd finished talking to them via the phone or after he'd sent the messages to figure out, you know, what people thought of him, which is a particularly paranoid, I guess, a paranoid thing to do. But yeah, the story's been kind of swirling around with some of, you know, lurid details like that about him spying on his lovers, and then also some of the impact on the particular IT guy and his operation, you know, running this kind of thing for the cartels. And then it's kind of gone onwards into an interesting interesting kind of side note of the involvement of Pegasus, everyone's favorite.
Well, before we get to that side note, I mean, I just want to make it known that El Chapo was actually using FlexiSpy to do this, the like consumer grade spyware that idiots put on their spouses' phones, right? This is the stuff he was using. And the FBI was able to obtain so much of this wonderful content by getting it from FlexiSpy.
Which, yeah, is you know, kind of ironic and funny, and yet also, you know, really underscores quite how sleazy that business model is of selling this kind of software, you know, nominally to, you know, so parents can look over their children and take care of them, when in fact this is what it actually gets used for.
But as you point out, you know, there is an NSO angle to this, and I find it interesting because this really looks like maybe NSO doing some PR to try to combat the perception forming of the company that they're a bunch of jerks, you know, and everything that happened with the murder of Khashoggi, you know. So this looks like NSO going, hey, look, we took down the Sinaloa cartel. Isn't that great?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're fishing for a good news story. And I mean, this one is interesting because, you know, it looked like they approached the Mexicans to try and help out, you know, provide a, you know, find a good customer for their product, you know, quite a few years ago now, back in, you know, 2011. And it got to the point where the president of Mexico phoned them to say thank you, you know, for their help in providing tooling to help, you know, track down various members of the cartels through owning their phones with Pegasus tooling, which, I mean, I guess they need a good news story, but yeah, it's kind of a funny angle to it.
Well, I mean, there's some other tidbits here, like they actually came up with a customized version of their software because El Chapo started distributing phones that were some sort of customized platform. Mexican authorities got a hold of one, sent it to an NSO group. They RE'd it and came up with a, you know, with a suitable implant for it. So, you know, there's some interesting stuff in this story, and you're right, they do kind of need a good news story, but I guess one reason this is interesting is because this is complicated, this stuff, isn't it? And you've heard me say it so many times, which is even horrible, corrupt countries still have legitimate security needs. I mean, personally, would I be involved in selling this type of technology to the Mexican government? No, I probably wouldn't. But you can see how some people might find that a bit of a dilemma. You know, you can sell it to them, they can target El Chapo with it, but there's going to be some unintended consequences because other people are going to get a hold of it and use it to target bloggers and human rights activists and people like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's that kind of inevitable tension, right, where you either develop the tool, vet the customers and let them do what they want with it and accept that you're not going to be able to have the degree of control that you would like, or on the other hand, you have to be involved in every single aspect of, you know, in the end, what is not your business. I mean, you know, a private company in Israel maybe shouldn't be involved in, you know, day-to-day Mexican police work, right? They don't have a role in that, and they're not accountable, you know, to the Mexican public in the way that their, you know, law enforcement are. So, you know, there's no real good answer to that. You know, you have to find some middle ground between those two ends. And yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that they helped take down a drug cartel, maybe that is actually a genuinely good news story, not just, you know, cynical PR.
Bit of interesting research or a bit of interesting observed activity FireEye has noticed, which is a bunch of people, you know, well, it looks like the Iranian government. They're basically owning DNS servers, changing A records, and then using Let's Encrypt to make everything look hunky-dory and man-in-the-middling a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, this campaign's been targeting a whole bunch of things that, you know, appear to be in Iran's interest to get in the middle of, both in terms of web applications and mail. Interesting, like that's sort of the classical SIGINT thing, to go and hijack the email. They've been breaking into, as I gather from the reporting, the like DNS registry services, or, you know, where companies aren't hosting their own DNS, where the actual DNS records are managed by, you know, by a GoDaddy or whoever else. That they're breaking into those through presumably single-factor auth password reuse phishing, and then modifying DNS records to transparently man in the middle of all, generating certs on the fly. It is worth noting that some of the reporting has said that Let's Encrypt wasn't the only thing they were using. Obviously, you know, Let's Encrypt, one of the concerns people had was that it would facilitate this kind of much more straightforward, automated you know, man in the middle of SSL through valid certs. They weren't the only cert provider being used, but yeah, domain control validation cert being then used to transparently man in the middle it. And there's a number of different ways they were doing it through, you know, either DNS proxying or application layer proxying of web services and SMTP, hoovering it up and off back to be, you know, analyzed in you know, whichever bit of the Iranian government's doing it.
Yeah, and it looks like a large part of the attribution here comes from the fact that they're just targeting people who are obviously, like the target set is just so obviously the Iranian government's target set.
Yeah, it does seem that the technical infrastructure is not, you know, directly attributing it to Iran, but yeah, the targeting and the intent does seem to be.
Kim Zetter has filed a really interesting story for Politico, although I can't say that I think the particular hook or angle on this one is one that really passes muster from my point of view. But anyway, the story is that it was Kaspersky, the company, the antivirus company, that actually tipped NSA or tipped American authorities on Harold Martin, you know, Hal Martin, who was the guy who it later turned out had hoarded terabytes upon terabytes of classified information in his home, because he'd been sending funny DMs to Kaspersky researchers asking for a meeting with Eugene and things like this. It's such a strange story.
It really is. Like, it's such a weird twist to a story that was already kind of complicated and weird. The fact that that Hal Martin was, you know, DMing random Kaspersky researchers and like obscure, you know, sort of drunk tweeting them, like, it didn't really make a whole bunch of sense. You know, asking for a meeting with Eugene and then, you know, kind of blocking them directly after, like, none of it made much sense. But then the funny thing is that the couple of Kaspersky researchers that he hit up eventually started Googling him, you know, kind of rummaging around, doing a bit of OSINT, tracked down his, like, dating profile on some BDSM site, and then managed to, like, you know, correlate the fact that he worked at NSA. And, yeah, then went and told the NSA, like, hey, maybe you should go have a look, because this was right about the time that Shadow Brokers broke.
Yeah, his first message came 30 minutes before Shadow Brokers did their first dump, and then, you know, the Kaspersky guys were thinking back to it, and they're like, oh, hang on, you know, that kind of lines up, and sent it off. But, you know, the angle that I'm talking about here is this article sort of makes it look a little bit like, well, you know, maybe this is evidence that Kaspersky isn't guilty of the charges leveled against it, or the accusations leveled against it. And I don't really see how this is exculpatory, to be honest.
No, I didn't. That seemed a little bit of a stretch. I mean, obviously Kaspersky is a big company, and, you know, the acts of individual people receiving messages on Twitter and then...
Well, apparently they did pass it up the chain, and they got, you know, approval from management to contact US authorities, right?
Yeah, although, I mean, it did say that the contact was made, you know, through someone that one of the researchers had met at a conference, you know, as opposed to through,
yeah.
You know, law channels. Like, it did seem like a more casual kind of thing. And I guess the idea that, you know, that Kaspersky, the company, is a single entity that's making consistent decisions, you know, across all of the things that are going on for it, like, that bit that seems a bit, you know, I don't know, it's equally explainable by, you know, people just going, hey, this is weird, that's a funny coincidence, I should go tell Dave that I met last week. You know, because it just seems weird kind of thing.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is too that we don't know whether or not the Shadow Brokers material came from Hal Martin's doc dump. I mean, that was my working theory for a while, and then it turned out there was the other guy, Nya Pho, who, you know, I mean, you looked at he was caught and charged over taking stuff home, and, you know, he was apparently the one who had a whole bunch of stuff siphoned off his computer by Kaspersky, and you look at the DOJ press release when he was sentenced, and it, you know, I mean, if you read between the lines, it seemed pretty clear that he was the source of the Shadow Brokers material. So Kaspersky dobbing in a guy who probably had nothing to do with any of it doesn't really make them look, you know, innocent of either wittingly or unwittingly being used by Russian intelligence services to do bad things.
No, of course. And it also doesn't, you know, mitigate against them being owned by other people who are also using their access, you know, other than
well,
Israelis.
Hence unwittingly, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Hal Martin followed me on Twitter, I discovered, because of this story.
No, he did not follow me, though. I was sad. I missed out. So only you got the, you know, the sweet NSA followers.
Now this is, God, a sign of the times, isn't it? The US government shutdown has resulted in a bunch of certificates expiring, not on like front pages, but, you know, some of the lesser, you know, subdomains and whatever. Yeah, there's SSL certs expiring because there's no one around to renew them.
Yeah, well, I guess the moral of the story is use Let's Encrypt and set up auto renew, perhaps, because then they will the certificates will outlast your job, or at least your pay for your job. But yeah, this is compounded somewhat by some of the sites in question, for example, some of the US Department of Justice.gov sites being on the HSTS preload list in Chrome.
Oh no! Oh no!
Yeah, so HSTS coming back to bite a few people in the bottom there. Some of the other sites were also previously serving HSTS. Headers and stuff. So yeah, for those people, you have to try quite hard to get around the browser warnings to go and, you know, apply for a rocket testing license from NASA or whoever else.
Last week we spoke about that story by Joe Cox where he paid a bounty hunter $300 to locate his phone. Wow, it's gone off like a hand grenade. This is what high-impact journalism is all about. And for such a simple story, really, like it's just blown up. Politicians are interested. The telcos look, you know, quite bad because they'd already promised they were going to stop selling this type of data or making this type of data available to third parties. It's good to see, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely, I imagine, the sort of thing that makes journalism feel rewarding, feel like you're really doing something useful.
Well, impact is what wins awards, man. Like, for real. Yes. This is great.
Yeah, no, he's done it was a really, story was straight, as you said, straightforward, but really conveyed it very well, made it very clear. And then, yeah, the results have been good. You know, senators doing their thing, the SEC, you know, assuming they get some funding at some point, want to investigate. We've seen pressure from, say, Google through their MVNO, cellular brand, you know, to make sure that the people actually providing their service don't sell the data onwards. So yeah, it's made enough kerfuffle and, you know, maybe it will have the desired effect of actually stopping this from being a thing.
There you go. An article that made something better. We love it. Forbes is reporting that a judge in the United States has ruled that, iPhone facial recognition and biometrics. Now, you know, it used to be the case that you couldn't be forced to divulge your passcode because, you know, you have the right to remain silent and all of that. But you could be forced to unlock a phone with your finger or your face because it's a biometric and it's different. Now a judge in the United States says, no, these things are equivalent in function, so deserve the same protections.
Yeah, this is from a district court in Northern California. So, I mean, obviously it's not necessarily a ruling that's going to apply US-wide, but certainly it is I think it makes the sensible argument, right? That, like, as you say, they are equivalent in terms of the outcome and that, you know, your right to not self-incriminate, you know, should extend to that. And the fact that it's via fingerprint or via iris or via a pin, you know, it's the outcome is the same. And yeah, it seems like the sensible conclusion to say that the law was outpaced by the technology and clearly this is what was meant.
Yeah, I mean, this one could be overruled any moment, but, you know, it's interesting to see it pop up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything else didn't make sense.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, what the case law and these kind of rulings are meant to do, to clarify the actual practical application of the law.
Now, last week we spoke about this ransomware attack, or we weren't even quite sure really what had happened, but this was the attack that affected, various US newspapers. We've got a story here on ZDNet that says that this Ryuk ransomware gang is probably just a bunch of Russian crooks and not, the North Korean state, as some people were sort of hyperbolically suggesting.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of write-ups from the usual sorts of, threat intelligence firm CrowdStrike and FireEye and Cryptos McAfee, looking at this particular crew. And yeah, it looks like they are using, kind of off-the-shelf purchased, ransomware tooling, and then they're delivering that through, a bunch of regular botnets and compromised systems, going through the list of machines they've owned and then kind of figuring out where the high value targets are going to be and then hitting them with this particular set of ransomware to try and make money. Analysis of some of the Bitcoin addresses that they've been known to ransom to suggests that this is actually working out for them. Something like 3.7 mil US, according to some of the research from CrowdStrike. So yeah, that's certainly pretty real money in anyone's currency.
Yeah, that's it. Meanwhile, in the United States, now this story, I mean, it's like, it's kind of sad because the guy is clearly just a bit cracked, but it's also kind of funny, right? Because this is the dude who said, I am anonymous and I'm going to DDoS this Boston Children's Hospital because I don't agree with, this. There was some really complicated legal situation involving, an alleged misdiagnosis and the hospital trying to, treat a child one way and the parents wanted to take her home and it turned into this big thing. So this guy DDoSes a children's hospital saying, we are anonymous. We don't forgive. We don't forget. Of course, he gets caught. Now, this is where it gets weird, is he goes to court, represents himself, expresses zero remorse, and as a result, he's just been sentenced to 10 years in the clink. So I think there's a few lessons in that for all of us, right?
Yes, there's several things. Well, number one, like, don't represent yourself. Number two, don't DDoS a children's hospital. Number three, don't try and flee to Cuba in a boat and then get picked up by a Disney cruise liner.
I almost forgot about that part. He got rescued by a Disney cruise boat, which isn't a thing that I knew existed. Did you know that there were Walt Disney cruises?
I did not know this, no.
Oh, it's wild. And yeah, his boat ran out of petrol or something. He got rescued by a Walt Disney cruise on his way to Cuba. It's just so weird. This story has it all.
It's such a weird story. But then again, yeah, 10 years in jail for DDoSing a hospital. I mean, 10 years is a long time in jail, right? There are people who do, you know, crimes that cause death that probably don't necessarily get 10 years in jail. On the other hand, like, really, you DDoSed a hospital? Like, what are you doing, guy?
You know, even if you're not remorseful, pretend. know? Like, what are you doing? Don't represent yourself. Don't say, yeah, I'm glad I DDoSed that hospital because I disagreed with what they were doing and I regret nothing. That's how you go to prison. I mean, trying to flee, representing yourself, like, this guy is just a walking example of, like, what not to do if you have legal trouble.
Pretty much, yes. Do everything opposite to this guy and you'll have a better life.
Yeah. He's not the only one off to the big house. Apparently, this other guy who goes by the handle Best Buy has been sentenced to prison. This was the guy who wound up taking huge chunks of the Liberian internet offline.
Yeah, he had a DDoS kit. He picked up a copy of the Mirai code when it got dropped, ran himself up a big botnet and was, you know, kind of selling botnets for hire. And then, yeah, like, some competing ISP in Liberia paid him to DOS their competitor. And, yeah, he took out the entire of Liberia. He also took out a whole bunch of stuff in Germany. And he was actually, I think, originally arrested in Europe and then charged in Germany, eventually sent back to the UK as well to face further charges there. Yeah, and apparently he's facing, you know, a couple of years in jail for his particular DDoS extravaganza.
Yeah, 2 years and 8 months in prison. You know, he was sentenced in the UK. Now, you know, we can see a bit of discrepancy there where in the US, if you knock down one hospital, you're in the clink for 10 years. And if you're in the UK, you can knock down a whole country and be in prison for 2 years and 8 months. Pick your jurisdiction. Oh, now, this one's heavy. Apparently, a cybersecurity executive at Facebook was swatted. Someone rang up the police claiming to be this guy, saying that he'd shot his wife and was keeping his children hostage. And yeah, they went all tactical and shit. And yeah, could have had a really bad ending, but thankfully it didn't in this case.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, obviously there's plenty of examples of where swatting really has gone horribly wrong. In this case, it sounds like the local police department handled it relatively well. No one got hurt. But it really just, I mean, the whole, you know, swatting in general is just such an awful thing to do. And yeah, I mean, we don't know for sure that it's to do with the guy's work, but I mean, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be surprised if you were involved in tracking down, you know, trolls and hackers and that kind of, you know, people who are screwing up the Facebook platform. You wouldn't necessarily be surprised if you see this kind of targeted retaliation against the staff involved. And that's, yeah, it's pretty terrible.
It is. We got a funny story here, actually. Cory Doctorow of Boing Boing fame, you know, quite a well-known blogger. He's got involved in a really weird little legal stoush with one of those companies that does, you know, rental electric scooters, which, and I'm totally on Cory's side on this one. But yeah, Cory's in the news. Tell us about this.
Yeah, apparently he wrote a piece on Boing Boing about this particular brand of, you know, kind of rental scooter. Where you rock up with a mobile app and, you know, you can take the scooter, go use it, drop it off anywhere and carry on with your life. Apparently people are selling kits where you can, like, go steal one of these scooters off the street, replace the main board with a custom
free scooter
one bought from China, and now you've got a free electric scooter you didn't pay for. Anyway, he wrote up a blog post about this because it's the kind of tech news zeitgeist, you know, finger on the pulse of thing that Boing Boing does. And then, yeah, the company, I guess the legal department didn't Google his name, because, I mean, Doctorow is a pretty unusual name. You might want to throw that in Google. They didn't do that. They just sent a cease and desist letter. And, yeah, that went predictably wrong for them.
Yeah, I think Corey's response blog post was absolutely hilarious because they clearly didn't have a leg to stand on. They're trying to go after him for DMCA stuff, which is about protecting copyrighted works. It was just funny. But there you go. And the thing that I've learned is you can now have basically a free scooter if you're happy just to steal one. Just take out the mainboard, get the other Chinese one, slot it in. There you go. And you can scoot around in low emission splendor. What do we got here? IT News in Australia has reported that another Queensland cop, a Queensland police officer, has been charged with hacking. The reason I highlighted this one is because apparently quite a few, I think four cops in Queensland, have been charged with hacking. And it's interesting because what they've alleged to have done is basically misuse police databases, and they are being charged with computer misuse and, you know, unauthorized use of computer charges, which I think is a really good thing. What do you think about this?
Well, I mean, I guess this is the other half of, you know, having computer crime laws that are quite broad and, you know, where you don't have to do necessarily what we call technical hacking, like where you're accessing in excess of your authority, as the law in New Zealand puts it, you know, using things you already have, but using them for purposes that they were not intended, and doing that with a computer is a computer crime. And that, you know, I guess we've argued many times over the years on the show about, you know, sort of the potential for overreach there. But yeah, this is the other side of it, right? Seeing these laws used to prosecute, you know, what clearly is an abuse of the position, abuse of the trust that they have and access that they've got. But then, yeah, having a charge with a computer crime, I guess, is, a good example of this.
Yeah. And we'll see. I mean, I doubt they're going to, you know, wind up doing hard time or something, or, you know, painting roadside rocks orange or whatever. But, you know, it is an interesting development. CSRF, man. CSRF is still around and doing some fun stuff. A bit of fun little web app research here.
Yeah, well, CSRF is very much still a thing. It's a podcast that a lot of web devs really don't put a lot of thought into.
As evidenced in this article.
as evidenced in this article. This particular set of research was by a guy called Paulo Ciabello, and he went around a bunch of the big hosting, like sort of second-tier hosting providers, the Bluehost, Dreamhost.
Yeah, like consumer hosting, you'd almost call
it,
that
kind of, you know, what we traditionally would have bought, you know, rubbish DNS and shared PHP web hosting off. Anyway, turns out bunch of CSRF against the various admin panels. He demoed a few bugs that would let you, you know, take over people's accounts. And obviously that would tie in very well with the sorts of things we've seen the Iranians doing, you know, where by taking over the DNS panels or the hosting panels, you can then go man in the middle of the services and work your way up into other access. He found a bunch of these bugs, reported them to the various web hosting companies. Most of them appear to have been fixed. But, yeah, kind of sad that a bug class that's, you know, really not very sophisticated is still so effective.
He had a really sweet XSS as well, where he could actually swap in the attacker's email address for the account holder's email address and then reset the account that way. And I thought, that's nice, man. That's nice. Well done. Who says XSS is low impact?
Yeah, well, exactly right. The impact is what you make of it.
Now, look, if you want to hack some stuff and win more than access to a shitty cPanel, head to Pwn to Own because, you know, there's some big bucks on offer because Tesla is rolling up with a Model 3 and some serious dollary dues.
Yeah, they've, Tesla have always been kind of, I guess, relatively bug bounty friendly, but yeah, showing up Pwn to Own. And in fact, you can Pwn and own the car. You can win the car if you hack it in particular certain ways. Tesla's got bug bounties for different sorts of attacks against the software systems in the Tesla Model 3, including things like, you know, remotely unlocking them so you can rock up and open it without the key, actually breaking into the, you know, the car's control systems itself, and that kind of thing. And yeah, the amount of money involved, is in the order of $700,000, plus, of course, the opportunity to win the car, which, you know, lots of people would like one of those cars because they can't make them fast enough.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a whole other story. Apparently, there's some bugs rattling around in SCP. You can attack an SCP client, right?
Yeah, now this particular story made me sad personally because I have read this code and I didn't think of this. I think I'm personally biased and I think this is a really cool piece of research.
That is a really distinct type of nerd sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, this kind of like malicious SSH server attacking SSH clients is a thing I spent a lot of time 10, 15 years ago looking into. And, you know, some of my early work that got me jobs in this industry was a result of that research. So I'm kind of sad that I didn't spot this. So, yes, I think it's particularly cool. This is a set of bugs where the SCP file transfer protocol, if you're SCPing files from a malicious server, it can push down files you weren't expecting and write them into the directory that you're copying into, which does have some pretty specific ways that you could turn that into arbitrary code exec. And there's also some really cool, you know, kind of novelty stunt hacking bits in there where this guy, Harry Sintinen, who works at F-Secure in Finland, he also is able to inject like terminal control characters into the file names so that you don't see in the output the extra files being copied in, which is just like, that's good hacking. Like, I big thumbs up for that from me. So yeah, pretty cool bugs. And also cross-platform works on, because it's kind of generic in the way that the underlying like original RCP, like file transfer protocol from the 80s, is used inside SCP. Anyway, works on OpenSSH's SCP implementation, on the one from PuTTY, WinSCP, and probably many of the other implementations of SCP as well. So yeah, I think pretty cool bug.
Yeah, and it's niche. been around 36 years apparently, which is
basically
good.
Forever, right? Yeah. I mean, since people have been SCPing things, which, I mean, you know, a lot of people were just copying stuff around the old way before that, but you know, not going to hack the planet, but there's definitely
just cool.
Yeah, it's good. It's good quality research, and I wish I'd thought of it.
We're going to finish up here with a blog post from our mate Shubs Shah over at Asset Note, and just a disclaimer there, I do some work for Asset Note. But yeah, he has written up a pretty sweet bug that he found. He used AssetNote to basically monitor Uber's environment. He noticed a change when one box that formerly wasn't returning anything started returning something, went and had a look at it, and hacked his way to about 23K in bounties.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, good example of, you know, solid hacking workflow, you know, having good awareness about your target, spotting something that changed, in this case, a new API endpoint coming up, figuring out how to drive that API endpoint. It was some obscure, like, Salesforce marketing, you know, kind of scripting language thing. You're figuring out how to use that to make queries on the backend database, and then, yeah, dump out all of the Uber drivers out of the database that this thing had access to, you know, using, you know, auth of anyone who's got an Uber account. And, yeah, turns into pretty good money. I think it was, what, 3K for the bug, and then he got a 20K bonus for being the most interesting bug of that particular, you know, period on the bug bounty program. So yeah, good job.
Happy days. Well done, Shubs. And Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. We will not be chatting next week. Alex Stamos is going to be along again in the news chair, but I'll chat to you again in a couple of weeks from Brazil.
Yeah, and safe travels, Pat, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news. Oh, and I'll mention this now. We're going to try a bit of a format change in the show this year. I'll be ramping that up in coming weeks. Basically, we're going to start inserting some comments and clips from Security Talking Heads into the news segment. I've been busy, quite busy the last few days, assembling a roster of 30 or so contributors, and I hope to get that properly moving in coming months. And once I've started that, please do let me know what you think. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with JP Smith, a security engineer with Trail of Bits. Every year, the Seesaw Capture the Flag draws thousands of teams from all over the world. Now, one of the diabolical minds behind the Seesaw challenges is our next guest, JP Smith, a security engineer with Trail of Bits. Part engineering firm, part consultancy, part development firm, Trail of Bits is a pretty unique security company. They get paid to do everything from secure software development to auditing and consulting, but they aren't a typical consultancy from the pen testing mold, although I'm pretty sure they could do that for you if you wanted them to as well. Anyway, JP came up with a couple of ideas for Seesaw challenges, and they're both pretty cool. One idea he had was to actually implement an already discredited quantum-resistant key exchange mechanism called HK17 and then let people attack it. JP wrote it up with the idea being that student teams would break it, and amazingly, they did. In fact, as you'll hear, JP says student teams just keep getting better and better, and two of them actually managed to solve one of his more advanced challenges, a hideous concept involving software written in Second Life's very own scripting language, Shudder. I'll drop JP in here as he's talking about the need for quantum-resistant algorithms and the history of HK17.
Traditionally, we've been racing Moore's Law decades in the future. So we were already worried about crazy sci-fi stuff because...
Yeah, future-proofing, right?
Yeah. But this is a different thing because replacing many old constructions was just use the same construction but with bigger parameters or hardened against this particular attack. This means we need to use all new primitives. So we're looking at things like lattices, which are kind of these discretized vector fields. Or we're looking at things like error correcting codes, or we're looking at things like isogenies, which are really freaky function on elliptic curves. So all of these things aren't even a whole crypto system. It's the new primitives to build a crypto system out of.
So NIST called for submissions on this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And they got 69 submissions, which is, you know, not bad, not a bad response.
Some people submitted a few times, and many of those submissions have been disqualified. And also, of submissions they got, many of them used very similar ideas, just with implementation differences of different sizes. But there are like multiple NTrue implementations in that contest, for instance. And NTrue is a system that we've known about since, I want to say, the 70s. It's kind of the prototypical lattice system and the one that's seen the most cryptanalysis.
Now, one of these submissions was one called HK17 Key Exchange, right? Now, this was in 2017, is that right?
Yep. Now, this submission is the one that... This was a really weird submission. I mentioned that we're using these new primitives. This used this thing called Octonian algebras. If you know about complex numbers, so they have a real part and an imaginary part, we get to complex numbers from the reals by doubling the number of dimensions and then defining this new multiplication idea. Addition works exactly like before. We can do that again on the complex numbers to get to these four-dimensional numbers called quaternions, which are pretty useful for graphics programming, is probably the way that your audience would have heard about them. But they do a lot of stuff in math too. We can double the number of dimensions again, and we get to these eight-dimensional hyper-complex numbers called the octonions. If I use those as terms in a polynomial, I get these Octonian algebras, and I can build a crypto system out of them. It's worth noting, though, that as we keep doubling dimensions, we keep getting weirder and weirder.
I did a fair bit of complex number theory at university because I did, you know, electronics engineering, and, you know, I'm just trying to imagine what this looks like. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I could give you to illustrate how weird they are is, let's say I have two quaternions, which are the four-dimensional ones, half as weird as octonions. If I have two quaternions, A and B, then A times B is probably not the same number as B times A. Which side of the multiply sign they're on determines the output of the product. Octonians are even worse. If I have A, B, and C, then if I multiply A and B and then multiply that by C, so open parenthesis A times B, close parenthesis times C, that's different from A times open parenthesis B times C, close parenthesis. They're not associative, and the order in which you perform the same multiplications changes what the output is. Very strange numbers. Anyway, I won't get into the mechanics of HK17, but the important takeaway is that it's really out of left field compared to almost the whole existing literature. And the other really important takeaway is that it is critically broken and probably unfixable, because these Octonians have these weird, weird multiplication identities. So it's probably easier to factor stuff with complex numbers, because I can factor -1 as 1 times -1 or as I times I. Octonians, it's way, way easier to factor, it turns out, because of identities like I squared is just -1. And in fact, the HK17 cryptosystem could be broken by a Python script that more or less just solves linear equations and does so effectively instantaneously in O of 1 as you increase the security parameters.
That's probably not what you want in the world's future quantum crypto-resistant algorithm, right?
Well, that's why we have these contests, to make sure that stuff like that never lands on your computer, because a bunch of world-class cryptographers looked at it first and decided that this is actually hideously insecure.
Yeah, so that happened around December, between December 2017 and January 2018. They were, you know, professional cryptographers looked at this and just went, nope.
Yeah. So then this summer I was in Santa Barbara for the crypto conference. That's IACR crypto, so not like a crypto conference, the crypto conference. And they were talking about this, and I was like, wow, that's pretty funny. I had never thought that that kind of a crypto system would even exist, let alone that it would get submitted and turn out to explode. Every part of it is just novel and surprising. So then later on, when I was talking to one of my friends at Seesaw. He was like, can you write challenges? And I was like, absolutely. I'll write this weird Octonian stuff. And he was like, all right, just do whatever, man. And that's kind of how the concept of HK17 got started. In qualifications, I pretty much just implemented HK17 from the paper. I read the paper, figured out what it was doing and how to turn it into Python, made sure that my implementation looked the same, but more or less just read the paper and turned it into Python. I did a lot of obfuscation of the variable names. I called the class Lattice, which is a completely different cryptographic primitive. There was stuff about isogenies and Gaussian stuff, and all of it was mislabeled.
But so we should make it clear that, you know, the purpose of your implementation was for people to shred it, right? Like you wrote this thing in order for people to be able to exploit it.
Yes, yes. Seesaw is a contest where people look at insecure crypto systems or binaries or whatever else, and then write an exploit for the vulnerability to get a flag in some time frame. They do this as many times as possible. So they would have to break crypto systems like mine, do some kind of, I don't know, stack corruption to do binary exploitation. There might be reverse engineering involved of binaries, probably some web stuff. It's really all over the board.
Yeah, so it's a pretty standard advanced CTF, right? That requires some, you know, some reversing and some real analysis.
I believe it's the most competitive college CTF in the world by a good margin. The teams you get here are really the strongest collegiate teams.
Well, and they demonstrated that because they ripped your implementation to shreds.
So, yeah, of the 1,300-ish teams that played, I think seven or nine, one of those two numbers, solved my original just obfuscated HK17. Which is pretty impressive. The write-ups that I read, at least one of them at no point realized it was HK17. They just came up with the attack on their own in parallel. And I believe that they weren't the only ones. In fact, I don't know of anyone who found the existing break that was a published crypto paper. I think they all reinvented it. Even in the past 5 years or so, contests like Seesaw have gotten way more difficult, because college students have gotten way smarter and way more competitive. You used to be able to run the strings command and get flags for they're 8-point challenges from typically 1 to 500 points. The HK17 implementation and qualifiers was a 400-point challenge because there was plenty of harder stuff. So you used to be able to get 300-point challenges by just running strings on them. But now there's they implement custom VMs that have their own ISAs. They'll make you put together absurd exploit chains. Finals this year had a challenge that was more or less just Chrome V8 exploitation that a number of teams solved. The generation of college kids that is really competitive right now is extraordinarily good at this.
So now this is interesting, right? Because before we got started, I asked you, I'm like, what's the takeaway here? You know, and you said, well, you know, it's just a story. There's no moral to this story, but it seems like one is emerging, which is that, you know, there's an up and coming generation of talent that you can throw into the deep end and they're going to be, you know, swimming laps all day.
I mean, I'll say that I was very involved with the CTF program, both at my alma mater, so UIU CTF and SigPony, and also online CTF groups like 1064 Seabread. And I think there's a really strong oral tradition too that's just started to get rolling. These kids aren't learning this in school or from the internet. They're learning it by actually doing the simpler versions of these problems with their friends in competition and by reading write-ups from past competitions. I think that there's just now starting to become this widespread body of knowledge that means that kids across the country can get really good if they want to, and top programs can always have several really good kids instead of just being kept afloat by one leader, which is the case almost everywhere, even 5 years ago.
So you're seeing that change. You're saying now that, you know, quite often you'll actually find a pool of talent as opposed to just, you know, one person who's making everyone else look good.
Oh yeah. I mean, you can convince yourself of this if you'd like. You can go on CTF time and you can look at all the past Seesaw competitions. And for all of them, they'll have links to write-ups. So go open a write-up for the easiest challenges and the hardest challenges, and especially binary exploitation and reversing, but cryptography is probably a close second. And you can just watch the difficulty ramp up exponentially and kids keep comfortably solving them. If you want to know about the really ridiculous challenge, though, you should hear about the version that I made for finals.
Go on.
So this is the actually really funny one, in my opinion. Have you ever heard of the game Second Life?
Yeah, I remember. I was a tech journalist during that time. How could I forget?
So, you know, when I started programming a while back, I was pretty convinced that the worst language out there was PHP. I saw all the crazy fractal of bad design stuff they had in there, the weird Easter date stuff and the global namespace, and I was like, probably the worst way that a programming language can be is like PHP. And then I started doing blockchain stuff professionally. I think we actually talked about this last time I was on here, about this language Solidity that's really just an even worse tire fire. PHP is super bad, but Solidity is...
I think I can see where you're going with this. Did you actually... You didn't, did you?
Second Life has a scripting language. It's called a Linden scripting language.
Oh, man. I can see where you're going, but please, just spell it out for us.
That's the worst language in the world. you should look at their JSON serialization code sometime if you want. It involves strided lists and deserializing to string encoded JSON in some cases.
So did you re-implement, re-implemented HK17 in the scripting language from Second Life?
Well, no, that would make it a lot too easy for the competitors, in my opinion. They'd already broken HK17, so I had to get a bit more creative than that. I did do everything in the scripting language from Second Life, though, which I was assisted with by my friend Dan Levenka, who deserves a bunch of credit, and who will come into play again later. So the HK17 paper describes a variant that isn't with Octonians, it's with unit quaternions. So these quaternions, but only those of distance 1 from 0. So I read this and I was like, huh, interesting. And then it turns out that this Second Life language has a built-in quaternion type. They mostly call it a rotation, but quaternion's an alias for that type. So you can just use them interchangeably because that helps with clarity and ease of use or something. I don't know.
So this is like complex numbers in a unit circle, or is it like a unit sphere for an added dimension?
It's a unit four sphere.
So it's like a four-dimensional unit sphere.
Yeah. Oh, so you can think of it as like a ring of spheres in four space.
Yeah. It depresses me that I understand what you said, but do go on.
Now, at this point, I had the ability to implement a pretty simple variant of HK17 that is described in the paper and uses the same principle in Second Life. But then I still had the question of, since these are on the unit sphere, they're no longer integers. With HK17 with Octonians, I can only worry about integer-valued points. With HK17 on quaternions, I now have floating point cryptography. So every possible floating point error in the LSL floating point implementation, which is, I do not think, even as unreasonable as the IEEE one, it seems... I spent a lot of time working with that, and I just don't know what's going on, man. It's pretty freaky, and I think there's like hidden point precision. One time I was debugging this code and I got to a point where I could multiply a number by 1 and get a number that Second Life didn't think was equal to the original number consistently.
Yeah.
It's like that level of sensible floating point. Anyway, I decided to write some cryptography around that. So I had the problem of how do we deal with errors? And then I realized that, as every schoolboy knows, unit quaternions just describe rotations. That's why they're called that in Second Life. Every unit quaternion describes some way that you can rotate a sphere, and in fact lets you really efficiently compute that rotation. So in Second Life, I just made... Do you know the IBM Selectric?
The typewriter?
Typewriter is notable for having, yeah.
Yeah, the golf ball
interchangeable
typewriter.
Font support.
Yeah.
You would put this little ball covered with steel letters in the middle, and then you would press keys that would rotate the ball to the letter you want and then stamp it down on the paper through the ribbon. If you want to switch fonts, you just switch your type ball. It was also the target of an incredibly clever Soviet implant that's kind of famous. So we got Dan Levenka's dad, my friend, to disassemble his old IBM Selectric and we modeled the ball in Second Life, then just use these quaternions to describe its rotation to a certain letter that would make it type out the message if you could figure out all the quaternions. Then, because we could do that, we added a little bit of random noise to all the numbers just to mess with any teams trying to do it with equality or not also model a typewriter. That was kind of mean, but I don't regret it.
So in order to solve this challenge, what did they actually have to do?
I'm almost there. I'm finally at the point where I can set up the challenge. The one piece of information that I need to give you is that my friend Dan Levenka is the biggest LaCroix fan I know, just absolutely obsessed with it. So he really wanted to make the challenge LaCroix themed. So players log onto this website and they see this acrostic with a bunch of LaCroix flavors vertically with missing letters and a Second Life URL with the same missing letters horizontally. So they figure out the missing letters in a bunch of LaCroix flavors, and it takes them to a Second Life location that's actually inside a giant can of this sparkling water. We had the wavy designs on the walls. It was actually underwater. We did have particle effects for the bubbles and even renamed the Second Life land Mud City, which is the nickname of La Crosse, Wisconsin, where the drink was invented. Once they're there, they see two glowing orbs. One says, click here for everything you want. The other says, click here to die instantly. Those were honest. I just wanted to see people die instantly after clicking a sign that said, click here to die instantly. And boy, did they deliver. anyway, they click here for everything you need. And they get this typewriter ball with an attached script, which they then have to reverse. If they look in chat, they see these JSON encoded messages passing back and forth stuff that this script parses and spins the typewriter ball around if it's one of the ones in the CTF. So all they have to do is take the script and this typewriter ball, reverse it to figure out how it works, eavesdrop on the Second Life chat, and then figure out from the unencrypted communications what's the typewriter ball spelling out. Oh, they also had to do some JSON parsing, and seriously, this Second Life JSON implementation is the most cursed thing I have ever read in my life.
So how many people got it?
Two.
Out of how many?
Out of, I think there were like 60 or 75 teams in finals that all did really well in quals to get there. MIT and CMU got it. I wrote it in large part just to mess with a buddy of mine who plays for the CMU team. And his team got it first. We bought each team member a whole box of LaCroix to celebrate. And then the MIT team is also really wicked smart and knows their math too, which is still not universal in these contests. So they were also able to solve it. A lot of people got pretty stuck, though. Saw people who managed to equip the typewriter ball as a helmet, so their head was just an IBM Selectric ball. Lots of people just tried to click the die instantly thing over and over again for like a concerning amount of time. People were trying to use Burp Suite to mess with a Second Life client. It was a very entertaining challenge to watch.
JP Smith, you are a sick, sick man, but thank you very much for joining us to walk us through your involvement in designing some of these seesaw challenges. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure talking to you.
That was JP Smith of Trail of Bits there. Big thanks to him for that. And if you want to hire a bunch of smart people to work on your security engineering challenges, get in touch with them at trailofbits.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in 8 days. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.